Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we are without Skype again, back to the phone lines, which is kind of challenging sometimes. I'm going to cover some stuff today that's pretty controversial. Let me apologize ahead of time if anyone is insulted by any of this or shocked or appalled. I'm going to go back to Genesis in the book, the Bible, and we talk about the creation of man, which I believe occurs somewhere in chapter 1, like chapter 1, verse 27. It's very interesting. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea," etc., etc., etc. It's interesting that the word is in plural here. God said, "Let us make man." So there was more than one. Either you say, the way religion does, that there was a trinity here, or you say there was more than one of them, as some people say. And I'm not really going to so much get into that tonight. But one thing I wanted to point out was in chapter 4, from the religious point of view, I would say this was the first man and the first woman, Adam and Eve. And then they had Cain and they had Abel. And then Cain kills Abel. And then some strange stuff happens in chapter 4. Because it says Cain lay with his wife. Yet, as far as we know, at this point, there was only three people on the earth, Adam and Eve and Cain. This has been always one of the strange parts of the Bible that I didn't think made logical sense. It's like part of the story is missing. And it was interesting. I had some Jehovah's Witnesses visit me. It's the second time they've been back to my house. I think they're interested in what I have to say. And I was talking to one of them about this particular passage, and where did Cain's wife come from? Because religion says Adam and Eve were the first man and woman, and of course they didn't have a real good answer. They speculate that it's one of the other sons and daughters of Adam and Eve. Assuming he married a woman. If you follow the religious perspective, then he married one of his sisters, which hardly seems like the right thing to do. And then the other strange thing it says here is that Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son Enoch. Well, not only were there other people, but enough other people to build a city, even though from the perspective of the story, there's only Cain, Adam and Eve, and then suddenly his wife appears from nowhere. We don't know where. He has a son, and then he's building a city. Well, it's also interesting that he even knew what a city was or had any idea of what a city, the concept of a city was. And this is just my own speculation as well. I think there were other people on the earth at that time, and I think that's probably a more realistic explanation of what's going on. Now, the Meyer material has some interesting things to say about this whole idea of Jehovah and who Jehovah was, because the Jehovah Witnesses always says the name of God is Jehovah. Well, the Meyer information explains that there is a whole lineage of people that were rulers here on the earth that go back to about 11,500 years ago, which was the last pole shift. And the pole shift occurred because of this great war between Atlantis and Lemuria, where the Lemurians basically powered an asteroid and slammed it into the earth in an attempt to wipe out Atlantis, kind of a revenge motivation because the Atlanteans had wiped out Mu at this point. So anyway, this was the result of this great war between two very advanced civilizations, Atlantis and Mu, who were of extraterrestrial origin. They were human beings just like me and you, but they were much more advanced human beings, and they basically pretty much wiped out the earth at that time. And there was kind of a rebuilding. Slowly society started to rebuild itself, and then some of the people that originally settled here on Earth, they were from Beta Centauri, and the Meyer information explains it's a Beta Centauri and another space-time configuration. But Beta Centauri is about 300 and some light years away. It's extremely long way away. The people that came here from there were very advanced, and some very interesting things about what the people at that time thought of them. They, one of the terms in ancient Arabic for Beta Centauri is, one of the terms is Hadar, which means to be civilized, to be on the ground. Now that's an interesting thing to name a star, unless there really were people that came from that star in the ancient past and settled here. Otherwise, you typically wouldn't name stars, things like that. And the other term for that star means to kneel. So evidently, the people that were on the earth at that time were kneeling in front of these people who had came here. So we've got Atlantis and Lemuria, a civilization that started 130,000 years ago, much higher advanced than we are, with things like the Great Pyramid and the things that we can't build today, all these incredible structures. And then we have a great war between these two civilizations, and pretty much the earth is devastated, and society is trying to climb back out of the rubble. Hundreds and hundreds of years have gone by, and a group of people come here, come to the earth, from Beta Centauri. And these people, the Meyer information calls the Giza Intelligences. And the Giza Intelligences started, about, like I said, 11,500 years ago. And there was a whole series of rulers at that time. And they weren't the best behaved, let's say. These people kind of represented themselves as the creators of the universe. They were called the Giza Intelligences. They lived far under the Giza Plateau. And the Giza Plateau had these old cubicle constructions underneath it that were about 73,000 years old. And there was a whole lineage of people that the Meyer material talks about, starting with a man named Eris the 11th, who was murdered by his son Jehovan. And Jehovan ruled on the earth here till about 3,600 years ago. And he let himself be called the creator. And he was murdered by his son Jehave about 340 years into his father's reign. Jehave ruled wickedly. He was brutal. He screamed for blood and revenge. He claimed himself to be the creator. And he had three sons, Erisane, Ptah, and Salam. And Erisane was the one that murdered Jehave. And Erisane went far below, and he was the one that settled in these old cubicle constructions. And that was the beginning, the true beginning of the Giza intelligence was the man named Erisane. And let me read what the Meyer material says about the Erisane and what he did. Deep in the interior of the earth and deep below the pyramids, they established themselves securely, whereby they converted the rooms and the constructions deep below the present pyramids of Giza as a center for their wicked purposes, from where they and their descendants since then tried to realize their tyrannical plans. But as of now, without noteworthy success, although their way of obtaining the goal of deceit, lying, intrigues was by wrong teachings and the leading astray of the uncorrupted earth humans through religious teachings. And these religious teachings, the Meyer information refers to as madness, cults, and many other kinds of evil machinations. So Erisane ruled and until about 3010 BC, and then Hen took over. Now Hen, according to the Meyer material, was the same person that's talked about in the book of Genesis, and he was the person called Jehovah. And one of the things that Jehovah did was wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah, and he destroyed both cities using atomic weapons. At least that's what the Meyer material says. And there was also an earthquake involved in this. And, well, let me read quickly what the Meyer material says in Contact 215, where Hen destroys Sodom and Gomorrah with atomic weapons. It says here, on the one hand, a meteorite fell to the earth and exploded over the area of the two cities, which would now actually be designated as larger villages. This led to devastating destruction of both cities, triggering a massive earthquake. So there was a meteorite that played a part of this. The earth was torn open like Petra, and there was underground volcanic activity. Many people were killed. And it says the remaining part of the total destruction was caused by the megalomania and the crazy god of the Hebrews, an extraterrestrial who had headquartered deep under the Pyramid of Giza. And his punishment for the disobedience of the population of Sodom and Gomorrah against his commands was that he let two small atomic bombs ignite over the two cities, which finally leveled everything to the ground, killing all the humans and all the animals. Well, I know that's very controversial, and I cannot prove to you that that was the case, but I think I'll bring up some things that might support it. And I'll bring them up here. I'll find them in the Bible. In 2080, Hen was forced out by his nephew, Comegall I. Comegall took over leadership of the Giza intelligences, and Comegall was there until about 1976. Now, interestingly, the Giza intelligences also influenced Hitler through a man named Hermann Steinschneider, who was part of the Thule or the Thule Society, depending on how you want to pronounce that. The Giza intelligence influenced the Thule Society, which influenced Hermann Steinschneider, who influenced Hitler. And Hitler would have actually been a good influence on the earth, but because of his influence by these negative extraterrestrials, which are called the Befoth or Giza intelligences, Hitler went kind of into a delusion. And that's why he went into Russia and he overextended himself and basically brought a horrible ruin down on his own people. Now, originally, the things that Hitler did helped the people of Germany, pulled them out of a Great Depression. They started to build roads. And then slowly, he went into kind of an insanity. And the Meyer material says that was brought on by these Giza intelligences through this man, Hermann Steinschneider, among others. Now, this Hermann Steinschneider also went by another name, which I can't remember exactly off the top of my head. But this influence, this extraterrestrial influence here on the earth, was going on in ancient times when the Hebrews were here. It was going on all the way back into World War II. And these Bafoth, or these Gizeh intelligences, they have a kind of hypnotic technology. It's called a telenotic impulse. And that telenotic impulse can affect your mind. It can control the way you think. And I think that many people are very vulnerable to this, particularly the people in many religions. And my material says this will still affect us for another 300 years. And this is what we're trying to shake off here on the earth so that we can start to live a little more normal life. Right now we're an insane society. We're rushing headlong to our own destruction. And only a change of our consciousness can help us look at things a little differently. And I think it's Numbers 31:7. I want to kind of staying on the topic of Jehovah. I want to talk a little bit about another thing that he did. And in Numbers 31:7, he sent the army of the Hebrews out to wipe out the Midianites. Let me see what it says here. The Lord said to Moses, "Take revenge on the Midianites for the Israelites. After that, you will be gathered to your people." So Moses said to the people, "Arm yourself, some of your men, and to go to war against the Midianites and carry out the Lord's vengeance on them." Now, let's talk about that statement right there. Now, the Meyer information explains that the universal consciousness, the intelligence that created all things in our universe, is neither good nor evil. It's a neutral, positive, spiritual energy. And it doesn't have vengeance. And it's not angry. It's neutral, positive, always. It's never too far positive. It's never too far negative. It's only concerned, really, with evolution. But here, this Lord's vengeance, the Israelites are told to carry out the Lord's vengeance. Send into battle 1,000 men from each of the tribes of Israel. So 12,000 men armed for battle, 1,000 from each tribe, were supplied from the clans of Israel. Moses sent them into battle, 1,000 for each tribe, along with, and it talks a little bit more about who they were and what they did. Well, they killed all the people. They killed all the people, all the soldiers, but they spared the women and children. Now Moses sent them back. It says, "Now kill all of the boys and kill every woman who has slept with a man, but save for yourselves every girl who has never slept with a man." So this is Jehovah telling them to go in and kill all the men, women, and children except for the virgins. And again, I would argue that the universal consciousness would not do this, would not kill every man and woman and child of the Midianites. So anyway, I just wanted to cover that. I'm going to let you try to absorb that for a little while. That's something you have to think about. And it's very interesting when the Jehovah Witnesses were visiting me, he didn't want to go into that. He didn't want to talk about that too much. And the particular argument of religion is that these Midianites were so evil, they were so bad, they had to be killed off. Well, if that's the case, then why do you keep the virgins for yourself? That doesn't seem logical to me. In fact, it also says they were the ones who... Anyway, Moses was talking a little bit about a plague that hit the people of Israel, and I was going to bring that up, but I think that's a little outsider topic. Okay. In any case, I wanted to talk a little bit about Numbers 31:7. I wanted to talk about Genesis, but I'm going to fast forward here a little bit to our present time, if I can, because I've got a little more evidence for something that I started studying months ago. And actually, what I really started out to do was to kind of disprove the story of what the Meyer material talks about Emmanuel and try to find, I've always thought, well, how is it possible that we could not know the name of the person who is really the most important figure in Western society, which would today we call Jesus? Well, let me put a link in the chat room here so you guys can see this. And I hope you take a look at this link, because what this is, this link is a photograph of a page in the 1611 version of the New Testament. That's the original King James, the very, very first one. And look what it says here about the testament of our Lord and Savior. It doesn't use the word Jesus Christ, but I-E-S-V-S, Christ. And that was what they called him before the letter J was invented. And if you see just to the right over here, there's some little engravings, and it shows the person we would call John, who they called I-O-H-N. And the person we would call James, his name didn't begin with a J either. You see, 1611 came out early enough where they hadn't invented the letter J yet. And that early, early Bible, you would get the book, for example, not the book of Job, but the book of Iob. You see, they went back and they changed, when they introduced the letter J, they went back and they changed all these people's names in the Bible. Now, we have this idea that our Bible wasn't changed, that it was, you know, so sacred that they wouldn't change anything. Well, that's not the case. They did change things. And what I've just showed you a picture of, if you're in the chat room, is a link which has the original 1611 version of the King James Bible. Now, there was no W, there was no J, or there was no U in the Old English. And there's a couple other links I could throw in there. For this interesting little thing on YouTube called the letter J. And it's this little splurge that talks about that no books written before 1600 AD had the letter J in them either. And even the important political and religious figures whose names begin with the letter J today were spelled originally with the letter I or another letter. For example, Julius Caesar originally was not spelled with the J, nor did it have the sound of J. And this is the same name with Jesus Christ. Some scholars believe that the words began and they were pronounced as if they had a Y in them, like Jerusalem, for example, instead of Jerusalem. The letter J is the youngest letter in our alphabet. The letter J never existed until about 1600. There was a man named Gian Giorgio Tarissino. He was an Italian scholar. He was from Italy. He was very knowledgeable in German, and he actually invented the letter J first in German, and then it went to French, and it went to English. And they created the letter J, the scribes did, by creating fancy eyes. And then finally, they just thought, oh, this new letter is so cool, let me go back and change, you know, these translations that were coming out. They started substituting in the letter J, and well, the J had the J sound. And anyway, this is how this happened over time. Now, people will say, oh, but Hebrew, Latin, or Greek, you know, didn't they have the letter J in those languages? Those were the original languages of the Bible. No, the letter J never existed in any of these languages, not Hebrew, not Latin, or Greek. Never existed in these, the letter J never existed in about 1550, not even in the Hebrew language. So we mispronounce all the names of the Hebrew prophets as well. For example, Elijah, who we call today, was originally known as Eliah. And another example that's kind of outside of the letter J is the person we call Enoch today was originally called Henoch. Just to give you the opinion of some scholars on this, they say what we have today is kind of a pseudo-transliteration of Yeshua into the English Jesus. And they say it went from Yeshua in Hebrew to Iesos in the Greek to Iesous in the Latin, poor pronunciation, forgive me, to Jesus in the English. Okay. That is the argument of some scholars. But this transliteration is really the conversion of a text of one script to another. And a transliteration is not a translation. A transliteration is not concerned with translating. So this is a strange thing that went on in history, and I think this is something that a lot of people really need to understand. Now, whether it's true or not, I do not know. But the Meyer material says that the person that we call Christ today was originally called Emmanuel. And what that means is der mit gottlich Wissen, the one with godly knowledge. And the godly knowledge of an Ishwish is meant here. And Emmanuel is one of the old traditional first names in what's called the Ur form. And the Ur is the most ancient form. In other words, it means Emmanuel is a very old name of the old Lyrians or Vagans. Now, the Meyer material explains that in the ancient past, and I think it was something like 280,000 years ago, and let me apologize for this bad connection. About 289,000 years ago, extraterrestrial humans from Lyra and Vega came. They were from another Lyra Vega system that was in a different space-time configuration. Hello, Salone. And they visited here on the Earth, and this name, Emmanuel, is more part of their tradition. So the Meyer material claims there was something called the Talmud of Emmanuel that was discovered in the 50s or the 60s. I don't have that information right with me here at the moment. But it was discovered by Billy and a man named Isa Rashid. They were actually probably led to this by the Pleiaren. And they found this ancient manuscript, which was translated to the best of his ability by Isa Rashid. Some of that was shipped off to Switzerland. Some of it was lost in a fire because the Israeli Mossad gunned down Isa Rashid and his family trying to suppress this information. At least that's what the Meyer material says. And now there's actually a new translation of the Talmud coming out. Because there were some original problems that came out, and I think it was because of Isa Rashid's religious background. He was a priest or a pastor in one of the one of the various denominations of Christianity. I wanted to talk briefly a little bit about an acronym that we see at the bottom of some of the ancient paintings from the High Renaissance. And I may have, I'll throw a link in, although it's not the best example of this. It's really a Wikipedia link. And I'll throw it in, but it's, you might have to click around to find an actual example of where this is used. In the ancient, 1500s, they had these paintings, and at the bottom of them, it would be a painting of a crucifixion. You'd always see the acronym INRI. Now, what that translates in Latin is Iesus Nazarenus Rex Iodorum. Iesus, again, is the early term that slowly morphed into Jesus, and that is from the Latin. And see, the Latin and the Koine Greek are really, really close. So I think that's another important bit of evidence there. Anyway, I thought that was worth covering again. It's interesting where the Meyer material intersects some of our older writings, like our Bible, and some of our history. Now, who is Edward Albert Meyer? If you've never heard of this man, you're probably wondering, wow, what is this guy talking about? Who is this character? Billy Meyer is about a 79-year-old man. He lives in Hinterschmidt-Ruti, which is a tiny mountain village in Switzerland, about 52 minutes east of Zurich. They have a building there. It's called the Semyase Silver Star Center. He has an organization. It's called the FIGU. It's a free community of interest. They help Billy put together his writings. Billy's written over 40 books. Most all of them are only available in German. There are 4 books that I know of that you can get in English. And probably the 5th will be the Talmud of Emmanuel. The 4 books are The Goblet of Truth, The Way to Live, The Psyche, The Might of Thoughts. Now, these are books that you'll have to read multiple times to start to understand what they're talking about. There's about the first 30 pages of the book, The Psyche, I think I read 20 times to try to understand it. And what it talks about is what goes on in the human mind, the human spirit, and what the whole parts of our immaterial selves are. The Meyer material explains that we have a spiritual consciousness and a material consciousness. The spiritual consciousness is centered around something called your spirit or your spirit form. Your spirit form, if you're a typical person on Earth, your spirit form is about 4 to 5 million years old. Now, how's that possible? Well, your spirit form reincarnates. That's the part of you that survives between lifetimes. It resides in an area called the superior colliculus, which is an area in your midbrain that controls sight. Your spirit form is completely invulnerable. It cannot be harmed by anything in the material world. Your spirit form was created by the superintelligence that the Meyer material calls the universal consciousness. The universal consciousness creates spirit forms to live in material bodies inside universes as kind of boots on the ground. So we reincarnate many, many millions of lifetimes, and we gather wisdom, and we evolve to higher and higher levels over millions and millions of years. there are seven defined levels of human evolution. It starts out with rational, primitive life, rational life, intelligent life, real life, life and creational wisdom. The sixth stage is kind of a half physical, half spiritual stage. And the seventh stage is a purely spiritual existence. Now, the sixth and the seventh stage last a long time, billions of years. And then we finally merge back with this universal consciousness that isn't Jehovah, that isn't a vengeful, angry God. It's a impersonal spiritual intelligence that's neither good nor evil, that builds universes as a part of its own evolution. But it radiates love, kind of like the sun radiates light and heat. And the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. Now, the creation, the universe, the universal awareness is not a old man with a beard who judges people and throws people in hell and some people he allows into a heaven. The Meyer material teaches there is no heaven, there is no hell. When your physical body dies, what comes out is your spirit form and your material consciousness, which goes back into the spiritual realm. The material consciousness goes into an area called the overall consciousness block, where your memories, your thought patterns are processed, and what comes out is what are called the essences of your evolution, like love and peace and stability and logic and all the things that you learned and accomplished in that previous life then are absorbed by your spirit form, and they strengthen your spirit form, and your evolutionary level rises in each one of these lifetimes. If the lifetime goes well and you don't devolve, it's possible to kind of degenerate in a lifetime. But if you continue to strive, and that's the key here, is continuing to strive, because striving is a creational natural law. And if the more you strive, the better off you're going to be. And the more you strive, the happier you're going to be. It's a law of nature. All of nature is designed to work, to strive. Even the lower creatures, the middle creatures, the plants, all the animals, of course, they strive. And you should focus on your striving as well. If your striving falls behind, it's very, very easy to go into a depression. If you're not working, if you're not focused, what happens is people become depressed. And this is a creational law. This is one of the laws of nature. So one of the important things about the Meyer material is it teaches us these keys to keep our life in line. Now, these extraterrestrials who are many, many years older than us, in terms of their spiritual life, in terms of their spiritual consciousness, have worked with Billy, and they met with Billy. Billy's first mentor was a man named Svoth. Svoth visited Billy when Billy was 5 years old, growing up in Bulak, Switzerland, which is northern Switzerland. And Billy started to get these telepathic messages from Svoth. And one of the reasons that Svoth was interacting with Billy is because of the age of the spirit form in this very, very young boy in Switzerland. And they knew the Pleiaren can detect spirit forms. And they knew that this was the ancient spirit form that has incarnated on the earth as Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. Now, the name Emmanuel is the name that the Meyer material says is the correct name of the person that we call Jesus Christ today, who I showed you was called Iesus, as little as 500 years ago. Emmanuel, the spirit form that is now in Edward Albert Myers, the same spirit form that was in Emmanuel, the same spirit form is in Enoch, the same spirit form that was in Muhammad, the same spirit form that was in an individual named Nocodemian, which was one of the teachers of the Pleiaren. So the Pleiaren have been watching for this spirit form to incarnate on Earth, as it has in previous lifetimes. And it has before attempted to teach this material. But because of the Earth humans' ununderstanding and lack of evolvement, the teachings were not preserved correctly, and they degenerated into the religions that we have today. And then we today in our religions have all these misunderstandings. And, for example, we thought that the person called Jehovah was the creator of the universe. And we wrote this down in a book called Genesis. And then we wrote some other things that Jehovah commanded be done in the book of Numbers. And I think it was Numbers 31:7 that I was reading there. And then you start to look at what Jehovah did and what he ordered to take place. And then it's very hard to understand the policies of Jehovah unless you understand who he was. According to Meyer material, he was an extraterrestrial human who was part of this Giza intelligence, who was trying to use religion to gain power, ascendancy over the people of the earth. And then you can start to see why he would order the complete wipeout of the Midianites, except for the virgins, of course. And you could see some of the other things in the Old Testament, they suddenly start to make more sense. And when you apply the right point of view, that many of these stories in our history start to make sense. For example, if you look at the Great Pyramid and you start analyzing it, and then you see these giant stones of, you know, granite, diorite, that are so hard, we can barely cut them with power tools, with diamond tip power tools. And the truth of the matter is we can't really cut them. We cannot really build with these gigantic stones because we don't have the technology. And then they try to make up these stories about how a primitive people could build something like that. Well, they didn't have the tools. They didn't have the understanding. Now, I'm not saying they didn't work on it. There were hundreds and even thousands of humans, not advanced humans, just regular Earth humans that worked on these structures. But the people that had the know-how, the people that had the understanding, the people that had the tools were from Orion. They were descendants of the Lyra Vegans and the people from the Pleiaren star system. And this is the part of history that's been ununderstood, misunderstood, and the part of history that we have to get back in focus if we're going to be able to understand who we are and where we come from and what's going on in the world that we live today. So I hope you've found that pretty interesting. I wanted to talk briefly about a little bit in one of Billy's books called The Way to Live. And I talked about that creational natural law called the law of striving and how important it is to keep striving, because striving is our purpose here on the earth. Let me read here. To be without striving means unwillingness and affliction. Affliction is inhibiting striving and inhibiting life. But inhibiting striving and inhibiting life bring inhibited evolution and stagnation. If you're feeling stagnant, it's because you're not striving. You need to refocus your time and efforts. If you're not striving, it can lead to hopelessness and grief. When you're properly focused on striving, you'll have a sense of momentum, a sense of purpose. Time will go by in a very nice, at a very nice pace. You'll have a stability to your life. But if you're feeling grief and confusion, irrationality, joylessness, cognitionlessness, unpeace, it's because you're not focused enough on your striving. Your striving can be focused on your day job. It means sometimes some of us, if we have a lot of type A personality, have to work on weekends. You need to focus on something. You'll start feeling disharmony and lovelessness if you're not striving properly. Self-deceit, all sorts of things. If you have harmony and happiness, as well as everything positive, then you have pronounced striving in your life. Depending on the degree of the strength of the striving that you have, you will feel that sense of peace and harmony and happiness. Let me read what it says here. Depending on the degree of the strength of the striving of any single vision, it will assert itself in the world and prevail, or will fall, shatter, waste away, and come to an end and vanish. So if you're not striving, it's not going to be good for you. You're going to have difficulties. You're going to have pains. But if you strive, then you're going to have happiness and a sense of focus. And one of the greatest things you can learn is the truth, which is the second creational natural law, the law of striving. And it's all over nature. All the animals strive. The plants strive. Human beings have to strive as well. You know, you can get yourself reorganized, get your life organized, get focused, and start striving. And striving, believe it or not, doesn't end with death. Because there's a striving on the spiritual side when your previous lives are evaluated, when the essences are distilled of your evolution. And that knowledge from the previous life, it goes into the subconscious. So even if you're a baby, your evolutionary level picks up where you were the last time you were on Earth as a mature adult and you hit the peak of your evolution. But it's all subconscious. So you'll get impulses from your subconscious. And you also get these impulses from the universal storage banks that will help you in your next life to get up to speed even faster. And you have to remember that death is an interlude between two lives in the realm of the other world. And there is striving in the other world. So what happens is, when finally all your previous life information has been evaluated and your spirit form has been strengthened, and what happens is you get a new personality, a new material consciousness, and then you come back into material life again. And you come out 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg, the spirit form is placed back into the body of the child. In the subconscious is the evolutionary level that you were at your previous lifetime, and in your subconscious are the memories of your previous lifetimes. And at this point of our evolution, we have to have those memories in the subconscious, because if they weren't, it would be so difficult to get through the confusion and the feelings that you had from previous lives. But I think sometimes we get subconscious impulses from previous lives. I know that in one of the contact notes, Semyase talked to Billy about his feelings of claustrophobia when they were looking at the people in the Apollo module that were docking with the Soyuz, and how small those two spacecraft were, and how the people inside were just in very small chambers. And Semyase said that, Billy, you've got some issues from previous lives where you had trauma associated with claustrophobia and maybe, who knows, I'm only speculating, maybe dying under a set of circumstances like that or almost dying. So these previous life memories, they are in the subconscious, and it's better that they stay there. Let's get back to talking about striving. Let me read here again a little bit about striving. It says, therefore, it is the case that the human being can learn from the unending truths and the wisdoms of creation and adapt and integrate him or herself or herself into following of its laws and recommendations, and thereby become so knowing that immense recognition and practical experience and therefore wisdom enter him or her, whereby she becomes a master of himself or herself with his or her own power of decision and power of determination and absolute capacity to act. But as the master of himself or herself, the human being is able to direct his or her own morality and disposition and so forth, and indeed such that a favorable equalizedness arises. Now, what does it mean to have equalizedness or balance? What the Meyer material always tries to get us to do is have a balance. And there's a balance that we should be. We should be neutral positive. We should never be really positive or really negative. We should always be balanced. And because if you get too positive, nature will pull you back to being balanced. Because it's one of the creational natural laws is there are these two poles. There's the negative and the positive. And it's always there. Even in striving, there's opposition. There's an opposition to your striving. There's kind of a negative pole. And this is part of the laws of nature. It's just the way things work. Now, striving requires an expenditure of effort. It must be achieved through hard work. So striving isn't just dropped into your lap again and again. You have to apply hard work to it. And again, as I said, there are multifarious powers which work against your striving. However, this isn't abnormal. It is part of natural law, because with no resistance, there is no effort for the progress. Therefore, it has to be in accord with natural law that an opposite pole, as I was describing, is positioned against the striving, because there's always two poles. There's a plus and a minus, a pro and a con, a negative and a positive. Together, the two poles produce a oneness and equalizedness. So that's what we're trying to focus on, is maintaining a neutral positive thinking, because neutral positive thinking produces that balance in life. And without neutral positive thinking, we can... it's called the law of harmony. It's maintaining this neutral positive thinking in your life. Put another way, this also means that no success can be attained without certain negative aspects also involved, which tag along as you develop towards success. Therefore, errors, we must inevitably make errors so that we can resolve them and recognize them. And it says, where there is life and striving, there is truthfully life and evolution. Striving is the impetus of life. Striving is the diligent impulse of the evolution of creation's drive up to the highest possible relatively absolute fulfillment. In fact, it says here that striving is life, right up to the absolutely fully developed being, which also finds no end in death, because we actually continue to strive in the spiritual realm. Death never means an end to striving. Striving does not end with death, because the death only means that the form of striving changes. After death, the striving in the realm of the other world is formed such that it concerns itself with the evolution, the processing of all that is collected from the realm of life, physical life. Conditioned by that which is physical, spiritual consciousness based, and it works towards renewing a physical life existence. So what we do, what the spirit form is doing in the spirit realm after death, is working to renew itself so that it can come back into physical life, incarnate, the spirit form will incarnate into the body of a child so it can begin its striving process again. But it'll have a new material consciousness, a new personality the next time around. And I like to think of it as variations. Because if you look at the Meyer previous incarnations, Enoch or Hanok, Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, Muhammad, they're almost variations on a theme. So even though they really have no relationship between each other, technically, they're similar. And it also states that when these spirit forms, they incarnate again, a lot of times they even will physically resemble each other. And in the contact notes, they'll say something quickly. One of the extraterrestrials will say, well, gosh, he looks just like, and then they'll say, no, you can't say that name. You can't. So it's very interesting. The law of striving, the law of reincarnation, the law of love, which we didn't really talk about tonight too much, and the law of harmony. These are the creational natural laws, and these are what make the universe work. I'm sorry about the bad connection. I'm sorry about the lack of Skype again. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.